Today on Vox Talks Economics, is the urgency of ESG causing many of us to prioritise gut feel over mainstream economics? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember, subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well. Every CEO, every investor, every NGO needs an ESG strategy, and they need it right this minute. But is that urgency making smart people ignore established insights from decades of economic research? Alex Edmonds of the London Business School is the author of a provocative paper that lists 10 ways in which conventional ESG wisdom might be misguided. And he joins me now. Alex, welcome back to Vox Talks.
It's great to be here, Tim. Thanks for the invitation.
Alex, to be clear on this, right at the beginning, you are not an ESG denier. This is about the strategy by which we accomplish ESG goals.
You're absolutely right, Tim. I think ESG is extremely important. In fact, I've been working on ESG for nearly 20 years, so way before it became as popular as it is now. So the reason for writing this article is not that I think ESG is unimportant. It's in contrary. ESG is so important that we need to make sure that we get it right.
Your focus here, I was very interested. It's on established economic insights, not the cutting edge of economics at all. Many of the things that we're talking about and we are going to be talking about in the next 20 minutes or so are taught in first year courses, as I remember. What made you go back to basics in this way?
So there's a common concern, which is ESG is so new and that textbook economics is so rooted in, say, the 1950s that we need to completely rip up the old textbooks and make up new stuff. And as the author of a purely ESG book, I'd like to claim that because I'd like to argue people should buy my book and not the old books. But that's not the case, is that we do have tried and tested practices that have been established based on research for decades. And what I'm claiming is that that research and those frameworks can be applied to ESG. Because ESG, while it's really important, it's also nothing really new. And we discussed this in the prior podcast that we had on the end of ESG, is ESG is a long-term investment that generates long-term financial and social value. But indeed, the frameworks that have been used for decades, they have also been used for long-term decisions, such as, say, 100 years ago, maybe a long-term decision was building a factory, and that factory might not be producing and might not be profitable for 10 years. So I'd like to think about ESG just like any other business decision, and therefore rather than shooting from the hip and making up new stuff, I'd like to use, to the extent possible, tried and tested frameworks. Now, there are some things where we might need to go beyond what we've done in the past, but I'm saying that maybe 80% or maybe 70 or 90% we can actually get by properly applying existing economic practices.
But, Alex, if we publish these tried and tested insights in textbooks, teach them to hundreds of thousands of students every year, and in markets and in the firms that make up those markets, we assume we reward the smart people who make informed decisions. Why is there any bad ESG strategy at all for you to criticize?
Well, there wouldn't be, Tim, if indeed the three things that you mentioned did happen. But unfortunately, I don't think any of those three things do happen. So let's take them by turn. Do we indeed publish these insights in books? Unfortunately not. So many of the books which are dedicated ESG books will be against the idea of shareholder value using frameworks. They're all about things which are more shooting from the hip. Do we teach them to students? The Financial Times, which I respect greatly, they now have in their new business school ranking the number of hours in core classes that you devote to ESG and climate change. And I think ESG and climate change are important, but they're so important that we should not expect every professor to teach them to tick a box. You need to have real expertise in climate change and ESG. So yes, we might be teaching ESG lectures to students, but we might not actually be teaching the correct material. And the third thing that you mentioned, Tim, was do we reward the smart people who make informed decisions? Not necessarily. So who are the asset managers, for example, who are able to get new money coming in? They might be people claiming ESG investing always pays off when sometimes there are trade-offs. They might be investors who always vote against management when actually sometimes it might be better to engage. Or maybe management does have this issue under control and maybe we don't need to interfere. So unfortunately, the marketplace is not one in which all of those things are happening. If so, I wouldn't have needed to write the article. But the reason for writing the article is to be constructive. It's not to call people out and say, hey, you're doing it wrong. It's then saying, well, this is the right way to do it because currently we are not publishing them, we're not teaching them, and we're not rewarding them.
Well, you found at least 10 reasons to write the article because you've got 10 examples about how we could do a better job of applying mainstream economics to how we think about ESG. Were there just 10 or did you have to limit yourself? Could you have found more?
I'm afraid I did have to rein myself in, and there were a couple that I already had to chop. They were on the original list, but then I found some better ones, so I had to cut them. I knew that I was going to go for 10, so I only sort of thought about 12 or 13, but I could have probably thought about 20 or 30. I'm sad that I only get 20 minutes to chat about them with you, Tim, because we could have this conversation lasting a couple of hours, but maybe your listeners wouldn't appreciate that.
If it goes well, then we'll have you back for another 10, perhaps, Alex.
Adapting to climate change is rational, but what policies make economic sense? The CPR's 25th Geneva Report discussed the options, and our podcast about it called Climate and Debt from October 2022 discussed how successful mitigation strategies could work.
Now, Alex, we don't have time to discuss all of these examples of gut feel replacing mainstream economics, but let's dive in on some of the ones that really jumped out at me. And the first one is this assumption that shareholder value is short term. I'm going to read you a quote here. The short-term performance pressures on investors result in an excessive focus on quarterly earnings, with less attention paid to strategy, fundamentals, and long-term value creation. Companies are discouraged from effectively managing the social and environmental risks to their business. Now, you've probably seen lots of quotes like that. That, however, is from the UN Global Compact. Do you agree with that quote?
I actually bizarrely do agree with that quote. And you might think, well, that's strange, but this quote has nothing to do with shareholder value. What that quote highlights is the problem with short-term performance pressures. And many people think, well, isn't that the same as shareholder value? The European Commission has a report on short-term shareholder value. However, one of the points of the article is to highlight that shareholder value is an inherently long-term concept. Finance 101, and in fact, the very first lecture I teach, suggests that shareholder value is the present value of all future cash flows from now until the end of time. And that's not just true in a textbook. It's also true in practice. If you think about some of the most highly valued companies today, like Tesla, their shareholder value, as shown by their market capitalization, is massive. It's much greater than the profits that they're making in the short term. So why is it so important to distinguish between short-termism and shareholder value? Well, I think we need to diagnose the problem in order to address and devise the right solution. Because if people think shareholder value is the problem, let's put workers on boards or customer representatives or environmental representatives and reduce the power of shareholders. But in fact, if shareholders are not the problem, there's nothing wrong with shareholder value but short-termism, then maybe the correct solution is instead to lengthen the horizon of CEO pay by giving them shares that they can't sell for, let's say, 7 or 10 years' time, making them continue to hold shares after retirement and so forth. And indeed, if you just look at what's happening in the news, often it's shareholders who are encouraging companies to go more on climate or diversity inclusion, not less. So shareholders are certainly thinking about these long-term issues.
Now, one other thing you disagree with very strongly in this article is that this conventional wisdom that shareholder primacy leads to an exclusive focus on shareholder value at the expense of ESG. I'll give you an example. In the UK, there's been a lot of news recently because a firm called West Cumbria Mining, it's about to open a new coal mine in the UK in 2023. Isn't that exactly the example of how shareholder primacy leads to bad ESG?
I think it's not necessarily. So this might be a more nuanced issue than we might think. Well, first, this is not an example of short-termism. Why?
No.
Because a coal mine, that's a really long-term project. It costs you a lot of money now, doesn't pay into the future. So if indeed shareholder primacy means short-termism, that's not an example of that. However, you do raise an alternative valid point, Tim, which is even if it's not short-term, maybe you're not taking into account societal considerations. But if so, well, how do we know that this is shareholder primacy that's the problem? There could be many, many other reasons for why this mine is opening. It could be government regulation and so forth. Often what we like to do in the UK is we might compare the UK to other countries and say, oh, why is Germany performing better than the UK? Oh, it must be shareholder primacy, whereas in Germany they have workers on boards. But there's so many other different things. There could be different cultural factors. It would be equally bizarre to say, well, the German language is why German companies are performing better. If we all started speaking German in the UK, we would have better performance. So we want to isolate one particular factor rather than other factors, and this is very difficult to do. And in particular, in this issue, how do we know whether the decision would be different under stakeholder capitalism? Why? Because there could be some benefits from the mine. It provides a lot of employment to people in the north. It might be consistent with the UK government's levelling up agenda. I've seen sort of groups form where they're actually supporting this because of the positive employment. Certainly, I am really taking climate change seriously, but this is not thermal coal. This is metallurgical coal. This is coal for steel making rather than to provide energy. Now, there is still obviously a negative environmental impact of just metallurgical coal, but what they're trying to do is take a lot of action to address that. So when you think about stakeholder capitalism, there are lots of different stakeholders out there. Yes, the environment is really important, but jobs are important. And also the people who will benefit from steel, which is made with metallurgical coal, those are also some benefits as well. So it's not immediately clear that this is a bad decision for wider society. And if it was, but we do have a government which is democratically elected, and the government decides what's legal or not legal, taking into account the costs and the benefits of certain activities on wider society. So there are some industries which, even though they provide employment, they are illegal, but others that aren't, because we do see a positive benefit from this, and the government has allowed this, and therefore this is something where the citizens of the UK do believe is net positive, even though there are obviously some negative aspects to it.
Now, one of the things that you return to several times in the paper is this idea of ESG doublethink. And you note that in equilibrium, investor returns equal the cost of capital. That's something you teach your students. So that we can't have both a lower cost of capital for ESG investments and higher returns for ESG stocks. And some campaigners claim both. Do serious investors make that mistake?
Yes, they do, unfortunately, Tim. And so let me just explain what I mean by ESG doublethink. So some people will be familiar with George Orwell's 1984, where doublethink is holding two contradictory positions. And indeed here, to believe that the cost of capital goes down and investor returns go up, that's contradictory, because in equilibrium, investor returns equal the cost of capital. Now, serious investors don't make that mistake within the same sentence, because that would indeed be inherently contradictory, but they have perhaps in different paragraphs in the same article or in different articles claimed, hey, ESG is good, it's good for investors, it increases investor returns, and it's also good for companies, it reduces their cost of capital. And this is to highlight that you can have either one or the other, but it's not fair to claim both. And indeed, some people argue that actually, well, as an investor, you should be willing to sacrifice some financial returns to make the planet a couple of degrees cooler. And people are sometimes quite happy with that. But if so, just be upfront about this and say, well, there are trade-offs. Sometimes decarbonisation is costly, rather than claiming that you can have your cake and eat it. You can always get both social impact and also financial gain.
I can't add up the amount of time over the past, I don't know, 5 years that I have spent discussing the efforts to improve firms' ESG metrics. And I've spent a fraction of the time invested in this that a lot of other very smart people have done. We want to improve the measurement of those ESG metrics on the assumption that these capture the firm's ESG policies' impact on society. Do you disagree with that?
I do, and that might seem a crazy thing to disagree with, because isn't it a no-brainer that if the ESG metrics are improving, a company is making a more positive impact? But it's not. Why? Because you can improve your metrics by dumping the problem on somebody else. For example, there was a nice academic paper which finds that after environmental incidents, companies try to improve their environmental ratings. And how do they do that? They sell polluting plants to other companies. So, yes, their own metric goes down, but other companies' metrics go up. And in fact, it might make the aggregate problem worse, because maybe you're selling it to other companies who don't actually really care about emissions. And in fact, what they find is that the emission intensity goes up after you sell them the plants. So you're selling them to people who don't care so much. So it's a bit like saying, well, I'm going to clean up my garden by throwing the trash over the fence to my neighbours, right? So yeah, my cleanliness has gone up, but I haven't reduced the overall problem of there being trash. And so this is why having a partial approach, just looking at one firm, that's different from looking at a general approach, which is to look at companies in aggregate.
This is a general equilibrium argument, though, Alex. So does this matter to individual investors who are focusing on the achievement of these metrics for one firm or one group of firms that they're investing in? Is this general equilibrium result really an argument for regulators to think about?
I would say that the general equilibrium result is also important for even individual investors. So there's an organization in the UK called Make My Money Matter, which I generally have a lot of respect for. So this encourages individual investors, people who hold pensions, to ensure that their pensions are invested in companies that have a positive impact. But they have on their website a really strong and I think quite irresponsible claim that making your pension greener is 21 times more powerful at cutting your carbon than giving up flying, going veggie, or changing your electricity supply. So here, the idea is that if you were to encourage your pension fund to sell out of carbon-intensive stocks, that has more impact than you not flying or stopping eating meat. But if your pension fund sells some of those high-carbon stocks, then somebody else buys them. So there's no aggregate improvement. Whereas, if you were to cut your flying, that would not only improve things in a partial individual sense, but that would also improve things in a general sense. So I think the idea of not considering the impact on wider society, that is also important for an individual investor.
How one of the other principles, one of the other pieces of conventional wisdom is that we should incentivize executives based on their ESG performance. You disagree with this quite strongly in the paper. Why would we disagree with this? We pay for performance in every other dimension when it comes to executives.
Yes. Well, do we actually pay for performance in every other direction that when it comes to executives? Well, there's two dimensions in which we pay for performance. And one is we might pay for financial performance measures like profitability. So you might pay an executive for earnings per share. And I would agree with the concern is that, no, we don't want to pay for earnings per share. Why? Because the CEO will focus on earnings per share at the exclusion of other dimensions. And that's also the same argument for why I don't like paying for ESG performance, because you might focus purely on diversity and not equity and inclusion, for example. So I would agree that we shouldn't pay for any of those dimensions. So rather than supplementing financial performance measures with ESG performance measures, I'd say get rid of all those performance measures. But then there's a second measure of performance, which I actually do think is reasonable, and that's paying according to the long-term stock price. So why am I supportive of the long-term stock price, but not earnings per share? Well, it's because in the long term, the stock price is affected by all the relevant performance dimensions of a company. So if a company is not generating profits, its stock price will go down in the long term. But similarly, if a company is not training its workers or investing in a positive corporate culture, then those workers will leave or they'll be demotivated. That will affect the long-term stock price. If a company is not reducing its carbon footprint, and then we have some government action, or even in the absence of government action, we have more customer action walking away from polluting companies, then it will also suffer decreases in the long-term stock price. So again, there's a little bit of a double think here. Some investors who are the strongest arguers against pay for financial performance, arguing that means you're going to hit the target and miss the point. They're also strong supporters of pay for ESG performance, not realizing that it will lead just to managing to the performance measures. And also, there are people who claim, well, companies should think about ESG because ESG is so important for long-term performance. But ESG is so important for long-term performance, then you just need to pay for long-term performance. You don't need to pay for the individual ESG dimensions.
This is a pretty long charge sheet you've got here, Alex. We've only just touched the surface of it. And you do point out at the beginning that maybe one of the reasons that we are making bad decisions is the urgency of acting. And if executives and investors, if they're failing to employ good economic principles now, do we really have time to wait for them to reconsider, to adjust their beliefs, to decide to act differently? Or does this urgency mean, okay, it's time for regulation to step in and, if you like, force good decision making on them?
I think we can wait for them to adjust their beliefs and actions, because I don't think we need to wait long, because the whole point of the article is that economic principles that have been tried and tested for decades, they can be applied to these situations. So I'm not requiring people to learn a new language or learn a new musical instrument. I'm saying, well, actually, speak the same language or play the same musical instrument that you've done for the last couple of decades, but realize that this can also be used for ESG. So let me give an example. When you look at evaluating any investment, you need to consider its risk. And the riskier an investment, the less likely you are to undertake it. So people will say, oh, I don't want to invest in carbon capture because it's risky. But I'm saying, well, Finance 101 tells you that risk does not matter if it's idiosyncratic, if it's not correlated with the rest of the market. Sure, carbon capture technology is risky. You don't know whether it will work or not. But whether it works or not, that's not correlated to whether the economy is in a boom or a downturn. Therefore, you should give a big green light to this carbon capture project, because you don't need to consider this idiosyncratic risk. And there's many, many other examples of that within the paper. But what this highlights is that we don't need to unlearn old stuff and learn new things. These are tried and tested economic principles, which when correctly applied to ESG, can encourage the ESG investments that we really need as a society.
Always interesting talking to you, Alex. And I think there's a lot of people who have an opinion about this. If you do have an opinion about this, let us know. We'd be very keen to discuss this further, because there is so much to talk about. But for now, Alex, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Tim.
The paper is called Applying Economics, Not Gut Feel to ESG, and it is discussion paper 17908 at CEPR if you want to find it that way. And the author is Alex Edmonds.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the best new research in economics every week, so subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you're hearing, why not leave a review? Next time on Vox Talks, when the next pandemic arrives, how can we make sure we manufacture enough vaccines?